Most of the focus when we talk about scarcity and the Bitcoin network has to do with the number of available Bitcoin to be traded and what that might mean for their appreciation and price over time. There's a really important secondary dynamic of scarcity in Bitcoin, which has to do with the available amount of space for data to go into each block and what that might mean for the value of block space as Bitcoin continues to be adopted as a global technology and monetary network. Our guest this week is an expert in this subject. Bob Burnett is the CEO of Barefoot Mining and a career technologist with some fascinating takes on where the value of block space could go as the world adopts Bitcoin. I'm Scott Dietles. I'm the CEO and founder of Block Rewards, and part of our mission in bringing Bitcoin to the workplace is helping people understand how it will help them. So if you're interested to learn something about poorly understood dynamic in the value of data in Bitcoin, stick around. This one is a mind bender. All right, welcome to another episode of the Block Reward podcast. Joined this week by a very special guest, Bitcoin legend, Bob Burnett. Welcome to the show, Bob.
Thank you, Scott. That's very kind. I think that might be slightly overstated, but thank you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'm not so sure. Yeah, I wonder maybe if just for the benefit of our guests who may not be familiar with, could you just give us a quick like 30-second intro to your history with Bitcoin and beyond?
So my roots are in the personal computer industry. So going way back to the mid-80s, I was an engineer designing what arguably was on the team of the world's first laptop computer. Eventually became the chief technical officer of a company called Gateway, which was a large personal computer company in the 90s, early 2000s. We were a Fortune 200 company. I left that in the mid-2000s, left that industry, did a bunch of technology incubator sort of work, but then found my way back to this space in 2017, basically through the personal computer, actually. And I arrived at this space because in 2017, an old Gateway acquaintance called me up and said, Bob, could you design some Ethereum mining equipment for me? He needed a bunch of Ethereum mining servers. And as a computer guy, that's how I looked at it at the time, I saw an opportunity to basically build something similar to what I had spent most of my career doing. And I did that. But that led me into the rabbit hole. We won't go into the gory details, but I was building these computers for Ethereum, but became disillusioned with Ethereum shortly after doing that. Although it was a very successful venture, but I didn't believe in Ethereum. I saw lots of warts, lots of concerns. And, you know, that led me to Bitcoin. So, you know, I started like a lot of people in kind of the alt space, although in a different way. I wasn't chasing number go up. I was building the technology for an altcoin. And that led me to discover Bitcoin. I saw the elements that were interesting to me because as a sidelight, I started studying Austrian economics in the early 2000s. So I had a different path in life had taken me there. And in addition to my technical degree, I do have a degree in economics too, but I realized that was a fallacy and found Austrian thought. So then I found Bitcoin and I realized that kind of technology and Austrian thought and the true libertarian thought process were kind of converging to create this masterpiece, which, you know, we know as Bitcoin.
So was there a particular moment for you when you realized that these ideas were sort of converging on this one piece of technology? Do you remember what the aha moment was for you? Or
it wasn't an epiphany moment. I wish it was. I wish I could say I listened to this or read this or whatever. No, it was evolutionary over, you know, probably an 18-month period or so. Again, you know, starting from Ethereum and developing that technology. But what was funny was where I lost faith in Ethereum was as I realized that Ethereum was planning to leave proof of work and go to proof of stake. So I hadn't really paid attention to consensus mechanisms or things like that. I was really just building this Ethereum mining equipment, right? That's all I really cared about. So, well, they have a roadmap to obsolete this thing that I'm doing. Why are they doing that? What, you know, and I started reading and it really didn't make sense. And so I found the warts of proof of stake first, then went back to really discover what proof of work was. And then really started exploring the monetary policy, the difficulty adjustment, the halving schedule, the, you know, all these elements of Bitcoin that you know, make it what it is. And so it's kind of finding them one by one. And, you know, I come from a technology background. I think technologists, we have a tendency, our initial reaction to a lot of things is, well, we could make it better. Like, right, you know, and a lot of times you can, right? I mean, technology evolves. So it's pretty rare that you find something and you start digging in and you think, well, why don't we do it this way? I could improve it by doing this or that or whatever. And so I had these initial reactions even to Bitcoin. And I know that probably sounds egotistical or something, but I'm like, yeah, I could do it better. But I think a lot of people, you know, have gone through that same thing. And then you realize, well, actually, I can't. You, when you think through it deeper and you realize, nope, the way the difficulty adjustment works, that's pretty perfect. The way the monetary schedule is pretty perfect. The way the block is constructed and the hashing algorithm and the double hash and like all these things is pretty damn perfect. So, you know, as a technologist, as I started going deeper and deeper, my awe and appreciation for it got greater and greater, you know, and it's a process through years, right? And maybe we'll talk about it later. I'm still, you know, now basically like in my eighth year doing this, still finding nooks and crannies inside the way the protocol works, way different things relate to each other. I'm sure we'll talk about it in a bit, like the way block space is created and managed. It has its own scarcity. We'll talk about probably some of those sort of things. There's still beauty being uncovered. I know it's like the Mona Lisa. You know, you go look at the Mona Lisa and you might look at it for the 100th time and you find some element of that piece of art that you never noticed before. And I think Bitcoin's the same way.
It's a masterpiece. Yeah, absolutely. I think it's cool too, because it's great for listeners to hear, you know, even the people who are so deeply in the space, you know, had the same journey. Like, it is really a common, your story is so common. And it's not an easy thing to wrap your head around. And there are a lot of common pitfalls that, depending on people's personal background and experience, can be easier or harder to move through. I actually wanted to ask you, before we get too far into Bitcoin, I first saw you speak last year at Pacific Bitcoin, and you had a really cool sort of sub story about your involvement with home personal computers and how that sort of in your mind started the decentralization of computing. And I just would love to just start there. I think it's such an interesting concept.
Yeah. So computing. So I'm 60 years old for those that are, you know, out there. Maybe you can't see, but you know, computing started in a very centralized fashion. The earliest computers were like super duper centralized. And there were massive forces that actually wanted it to stay centralized. And, you know, IBM, Digital Equipment Corporation, like these sort of corporations would all build these minis and mainframes and all that. And as we went into the early 80s, the IBM PC came out, the first Apple computers came out. What that really was the decentralization of compute and information, right? It was moving that power from a centralized place out to the edge. And, you know, with that came tremendous power, tremendous freedom. And so the people of the time that were in the computing business didn't understand that power. And they basically all failed. All of those companies that were building those types of computers, we used to call them mainframes. I don't know if anybody knows that name, but it used to be like the mainframe computer. And then they had something called the mini computer, but the mini computer was still a computer that was in a closet. And individual people had a terminal, meaning they'd have a keyboard and a monitor, but the thing on the end was dumb. It didn't know, you could only request. So you could think of it also as a permission system, right? Like you had to request computing power. You had to request information from a central authority, and that central authority would decide if they would provide that to you. That was the only way that it happened. You know, well into the 80s, really, that was the model. But with the creation of the PC, and I think the seminal moment was really the creation of the IBM PC. Ironically, it was a skunk's work project at IBM that they did not even believe in. It was just kind of a small group of people who were set aside to design this thing almost as a hobby experiment. And it ended up becoming the most successful computer ever made. Everything that we compute with today owes its DNA to that moment. And I became involved in that. You know, I just happened to be of the right age and an engineer coming out at the right time to align with that. And my involvement was in the mobile computing area, which is, of course, then taking that even a step further. The desktop computer was, you know, the first step of decentralizing that information. But then by cutting the cords, right, you know, we, by no longer making it power, that was what we were trying to do. And I did get that. That was, I guess, one of the things that clicked with me. I did have an epiphany moment in that time frame. Like, hey, if we can cut the cord and this compute power can be on airplanes and mountaintops and log cabins in the woods and, you know, wherever we are, I mean, that is the future. And obviously we're here today, and it probably seems obvious, but it was not obvious 40 years ago. That was what was going to happen.
I think it's so interesting, you know, so, and it would have been around that same time where a lot of the different technologies that actually make Bitcoin possible were also being sort of worked on and early versions of created. Like it's a very common misconception that Bitcoin sort of appeared. It was really the first successful time that a number of these different things had been combined into one thing.
Yeah. And I would also say the personal computer was actually part of the Bitcoin journey itself, right? That we didn't know that was going to happen at that time, obviously, but we had to decentralize compute before Bitcoin could evolve. That was, I think, one piece. And the second piece where the personal computer helped is you had to have a massive disbursement of those. And so I think, you know, there's a progression. The personal computer, without the personal computer, there is no internet. That the internet needed hundreds of millions of personal computers capable of creating the internet in that way. Because the internet back then, it exists, right? A form of the internet existed. But it was just those mainframes talking to each other. It needed hundreds of millions of personal computers. So I view the personal computer as kind of the base layer of the internet. And then obviously without the internet, we don't have Bitcoin. Obviously there's all the cryptography and, you know, other things that needed to come in parallel for Bitcoin to happen. But, you know, I believe the journey that I've taken, it has been like so fortuitous, like to live in this time and at a personal level to have been in a place where I could help create the earliest personal computers and mobile computing and then be part of the internet and, you know, its dispersion, its adoption. And honestly, I thought that was, you know, at the time I left the personal computer industries in the mid-2000s, I kind of thought I was done. Not, you know, I thought I had made my contribution. I had been part of essentially two revolutions. And it was hard for me to imagine that there might be another one that I could still be part of, because it seems like just those two, if you list like the great innovations of mankind, like, you know, I make your own list, right? But I would guess those two things, the personal computer and the internet, are going to make any top 50 list of all time, you know, going, you know, the printing press and electricity and clock and all that. Like, they're going to be up in that list. Go, well, I got a chance to be part of two of them. And it was kind of depressing to me, honestly, at a personal level. There was a realization to me, because I would have been, I was probably 45 years old at the time that that happened. And I knew I had a lot of years left to me. And I was no longer in a place where I was making that kind of contribution to the world. Like, I was used to doing something that had such immense purpose, you know? And then I was, as I left that, and my wife would even tell you, she said this specifically, she said, you know, she could see my like aura, my energy draining, like as those years went by from like 2004, 2005, when I left to 2017, she could see the life in me kind of dwindling. You know, because I had my family, I had those things, and that's wonderful. That's more than enough. But I had been so immersed in these other things that provided such purpose in on a professional side for me and so much stimulation to me. And then they weren't there. And then Bitcoin came and like, hey, I'm back. But like, you know, and I think it can ride this one to the sunset now, right? There's a lot of work to do, right? And it won't happen in the next year or two. It's a couple decades of work, at least, and probably a couple centuries of work, actually. I believe Bitcoin is money for the next 1,000 years, for the next millennium. And, you know, but we have to do the right things now to make sure that happens.
Yeah. And it's, you know, to your point about, it's like this evolution of the decentralization of the internet is a continual unfolding. This is something that will be ongoing as more and more subsequent technologies and both enable the further, you know, sort of physical, literal decentralization, but also like unlock new ways of thinking about what that might even mean and how we can erect systems and communities for it to function.
Yeah, who knows where it leads? We don't really know. But you know, what's I think interesting, as you said, like there's this movement toward decentralization of computing power and of information. And now I think we're trying to decentralize money or value or, you know, however you want to define Bitcoin, right? What it is to you. To me, it's the stripping value naked. You know, like, I think that's what we're trying to do. Like value has been so corrupted and distorted in the world. And, you know, with Bitcoin, we are laying it bare. Like, you know, because people will say, and I believe, you know, Bitcoin is truth. Well, you know, to me, it's exposing value at the bare level. And until you do, until everybody can have a fair perspective of value, then everything is wrong. Compensation systems, valuing labor, valuing goods, you know, commerce, all these things are based on a lie. And, you know, now we have a chance for truth. And there's going to be a lot of forces that don't want that to happen. And so, you know, we're going to fight a continual centralization force. But again, because of the way Bitcoin has been created, it has all the tools in place to fight that. It's only if we let them get corrupted, I think, that it fails. It is not infallible, but it is infallible if we use it right, if we maintain it right, if we take care of it. But already we have forces that feel the threat and are pushing us toward centralization. And if we let that happen, then we don't get true value. We don't get the Bitcoin that I think that we all fight for.
Yeah, certainly, you know, sort of the institutional investment products, even just early on, seem like that's part of what could be, you know, happening or force there. I think about, you know, you see sort of almost daily headlines now of AAA rated high-rise towers in the different metropolitan areas being sold for 10 cents on the dollar, and the market really struggling to understand how this is happening and how it's possible. And you know, yeah, to your point about stripping value bare, like we, I think, are in the early stages of a sort of like repricing of everything that has to relate to understanding what Bitcoin does. And you're really at the forefront of this, I think. And this is kind of where I want to go with the conversation, because of your involvement in mining gives you a different perspective on most of the conversations we have to do with Bitcoin the monetary instrument and how people can think about Bitcoin. But there is a sort of an entirely different and very important dynamic happening sort of just below the surface that involves with something called block space. And I'd love to go there.
Yeah. So for those that are maybe a little new to this, so block space, Bitcoin is based on blocks. I think everybody knows that. And we know the word blockchain, but you know, what is a block really? And a block is a, in simple terms, a conglomeration of transactions that have been confirmed or validated by the miners. So it's using the fiat terms, it's kind of like a check that has been approved or a credit card transaction that has been approved. And the Bitcoin network is constructed in a way such that these blocks come on average every 10 minutes. Now that's the mean, by the way, for those mathematics. The mean is 10 minutes, a little side piece of data. The median, so 50% of the blocks come in about 6 minutes and 40 seconds, and 50% come over that. So the network typically operates in that window, right? Well, just because you initiate a transaction, like if I want to send you a Bitcoin, Scott, and I go and I initiate that transaction, it's been signed. So I think a good analogy is it's equivalent to me signing the check and giving it to you, Scott. And even equivalent to you presenting it to your bank and depositing it, but it's not recognized yet, right? There's a process by which that check has to clear and actually truly you're in possession of whatever value I've been trying to transfer to you. Well, all the transactions that are in that bucket sit inside something called a mempool. The mempool, in simple terms, you could think of it as right now, it's about 150,000 transactions that sit there. And over the last 18 months, there's typically between 150 and 500,000 of those waiting to get included. But Bitcoin has a finite size to its blocks. And so it's technically called 4 million weight units, but it roughly translates to about 4,000 transactions. So the miners, we'll get into more specifics later, but the miners can only pick 4,000 of the 150 to include in the next block. Now, interestingly, they can use whichever criteria they want to pick the 4,000. Now, historically, they've picked the ones that have the highest fees. Now, the fees are at the point I initiated the transfer, I could offer a tip. I could think of it a tip or a bribe. In addition to the one Bitcoin that I was sending you, Scott, because I was buying your car, let's say, I could say, well, here's another 10,000 sats or whatever the number I wish is. And that's like a pick me or bribe to the mining network. But they don't have to pick you. They could pick anyone that they want based on whatever criteria they want. So what does that mean? That means that those miners are in a very important position. Number one, we'll get into more of that later, but it also means that there's a very finite amount of transactions that can be processed. So if there are about 4,000 transactions every block, and if you extrapolate the 10 minutes average number of per block, that extrapolates to 53,000 blocks a year. So that means on an annual basis, the network has a capacity of just over 200 million transactions. And there's really nothing that will practically be done to ever change that. Because it can only be done by essentially either increasing the rate at which we process, but there's a very specific reason Satoshi built it with 10-minute blocks, which is another element of his brilliance, or we have to make the blocks bigger. The Bitcoin community went through a whole war called the block size wars about that. And it's not going to change, right? At least probably in our lifetimes, this is not going to change. So we're stuck with this. But it creates actually, I think, all the right balance and incentives. And that if we made it bigger and more could go in, well, then it wouldn't be very scarce and there wouldn't be enough fees for the miners to maintain the network. It would also make it very difficult for people to run nodes and to keep the decentralization and power of securing the network, those things would go away. And same, by the way, if we increase the speed of the block times, that the same dynamic happens, that it would turn out that those are very centralizing forces. So we have to learn to live with the 200 million. But if you think about 200 million transactions annually, think, well, there's 8 billion people in the world. There's 330 million corporations in the world. They have to share 200 million transactions annually. So meaning, put the math another way, if I had enough Bitcoin and I wanted to give Bitcoin to every person in the world, and there's 8 billion people in the world, it would take me about 40 years, consuming 100% of the network capacity to do that. So it leads to some things that I think people have missed, even within the community, that concepts like self-custody and not your keys, not your coin, will not be available to everybody. The math doesn't support that. No, we most of the world will live above the base layer. So where this activity, they'll live in Lightning or Fedimint or Fedimint constructs or Arc or, you know, whatever. I'm sure there will be multiple layer two and layer three solutions, but that's where the world must be. And a lot of, even you talked about like these big financial institutions moving in, there's a certain cringe that comes with that and a certain concern that comes with that. But there's also a certain reality in that there has to be some way for people to get access to Bitcoin, given like for 8 billion people to get access to Bitcoin, given that only 200 million transactions a year can take place. And so I think we've done a disservice to a certain degree, and I know this will offend some people. We shouldn't really be saying and promoting like not your keys, not your coin in the way I think it's presented, because that essentially is saying that Bitcoin is not accessible to everybody. Like the math doesn't work. It doesn't mean I like it, but that's the way the math worked. And I think it comes from, so miners get rewarded through something called the block reward. It's the name of your show, right? So the block reward is the subsidy plus the fees. Okay. So, and the subsidy is currently 3 1/4 or 3 1/8 Bitcoin, plus whatever fees are in that block. I think the common belief is that the subsidy is a reward for the miners for the work that they do. That is not really accurate. I think people also have missed this. It's my belief that the subsidy, while it did provide that revenue stream for the miners, was really a way for users of Bitcoin to get essentially free access to the base layer during the adoption period. So it was subsidizing the users, not the miners. And we're reaching a point, though, where that's about to go away. So I think we've gotten 15 years of the subsidy providing essentially free access to Bitcoin. And until the last year and a half, it was essentially unobstructed, because the mempool, instead of having a few hundred thousand transactions pending, or you could think waiting for confirmation, it was almost always wide open, like for most of Bitcoin's history, meaning users could get essentially free instantaneous access to the base layer. And so the subsidy was providing that to the users to encourage adoption, to encourage usage, to create a base of people that would evangelize Bitcoin and facilitate its adoption. But we're at the crossover point, in my opinion. We're at the point where the free, unlimited access to Bitcoin is over, and now we have to start paying for it. And it's only fair, you know, to have access to an immutable, censorship-free monetary system. It doesn't make sense that would be free forever. So I've been going for a while that you
No, that's great. So to come back to the reality of the finite nature of block space, what we tend to focus on is the finite nature of Bitcoin, the money system. But there is a secondary scarcity by the nature of how many transactions can be fit into blocks. And you have some thoughts around what this will mean over time. So if we're coming to the end of, free usage of the block space, and we're likely about to be onboarding a lot more of the rest of the world. What will this mean for the future of the value of block space as opposed to Bitcoin?
Well, I think, first of all, you're right. So the scarcity. So, you know, 53,000 blocks a year. That's it. That's not going to change. In fact, you could argue block space is scarcer than Bitcoin. And that also probably sounds like a radical concept. The reason it's scarcer is that each piece of block space is a one-time usage. But Bitcoin can move, right? So the same Bitcoin can facilitate lots of transactions. The same Bitcoin can be used over and over and over again. But block space is a one-time use thing. Now, some people have argued, no, Bob, you're wrong. It's because what I will say is block space is absolutely scarce in any window of time. So for today, for this next week, for this next year, for the rest of my life, whatever it is. And I can, for the most part, define what that is. And so that's an interesting concept that you know, it has that finality. But once block space is used, it can't be reused. It's like So we're at a point now where the demand for block space always exceeds the availability of block space. That's why for 18 months, we've been in this position. We've seen periods over the last 18 months where that scarcity has driven fees through the roof. We've already had several windows where within the block reward, which is again subsidy plus fees, where the fees were greater than the subsidy in certain windows. Now, typically, it's only about 5% or so of the reward, but when demand goes up, a lot of it's been around a lot of the ordinals and inscription sort of stuff, which I'm not really a fan of. But what it has done is it's when it spikes demand in block space, you see how the market reacts to that scarcity. Because like I give this example about scarcity sometimes to say, you know, imagine I have an apple tree. It's the only apple tree in the world. And if every day I have, it produces 100 apples a day, right? If demand for those apples is 95 apples a day and I'm throwing five away every day, those apples are still pretty cheap. Those 95 I sell are pretty cheap. But the moment there's 101 people that want apples, the price skyrockets. And when 120 people want apples, it's astronomical. So it means there's a nonlinear relationship as you're reaching that, you know, it's basic economics, right? But there's this nonlinear relationship between supply and demand. And we're sitting, for the most part, right under that threshold. The Bitcoin network, in my analogy, sits at 95 apples of demand and there's an urgency too that goes with this, right? So the people that are in the queue don't have the urgency typically. But anyway, the point being that as we cross over this point, it's my belief that fees will become truly astronomical and jaw-dropping, which again is, I think, distressing to certain people, especially some of the old guard within Bitcoin that, you know, again, not your keys, not your Bitcoin, like, you know, they value their privacy. And I'm not telling them they're wrong. I'm just saying that the mathematics are not supporting some of these things, like, you know, your ability to access the base layer and do the things that a lot of people are very accustomed to is just not going to be there.
So I think, you know, part of what I've seen you forecast as well is an evolution of the kind of actor that will then be able to be resourced sufficiently to access the base layer transactions in the future. And would love to just maybe paint that picture for the audience of where you think this could evolve to with the importance of accessing the scarcity of block space.
So today, I think if you ask the typical person to think of what is a miner, they'll think of either a pleb running an S19 in their garage, or they'll think of a Riot or Marathon type mining company. But in both cases, the common element is they think of miner as a company chasing the block reward, a share of the block reward. And they think of them as purely economic actors chasing that block reward. For the most part today, that's true. That's the way it has been. But I believe it changes radically in the future. And again, this will probably be distressing to people, but I believe that nation states and big financial institutions will become the miners of the future. Not the only miners, but they will become miners and they will become big miners. If you think of a world where, fast forward X number of years, Bitcoin is now at a minimum a viable alternative economy is running on Bitcoin. Nations are trading goods with each other in Bitcoin on a regular basis. I think we're seeing the early days of that now, right? We're seeing nations doing that. We're seeing nations trying to protect themselves against actions like the U.S. took with Russia of, you know, seizing assets and kicking them off the system. They're going to say, hey, we don't want to be part of this. So what they're going to want to do is they're going to want to have, they're not going to not only own Bitcoin, but they need to be sure that they have access to the base layer. And the way to have access to the base layer is to be a miner. You must be a miner. So this is the way I think it plays out. If I am the, let me think of a country. I am the president of Libya. What I would be doing right now is I would be building a mining network with the goal of probably controlling 0.5% of the world's hashing power and mining 0.5% of the world's blocks, 0.5% of the world's blocks, which means I get one block every little bit more than a day. It takes me a little bit more than one day. I get a block. And therefore, I now have the ability to do commerce both at the nation state level and the countries and citizens within my domain. I can guarantee them that they can participate in the world economy in an uncensored, uncapturable way.
Because as you mentioned, miners can construct the blocks however they want.
Correct. And so as the country of Libya, I am not motivated by the block reward. I don't give a crap about the 3 Bitcoin I might earn for the block reward. What I care about is the sovereignty of my country. Like, my country is not sovereign. My country is not able to participate economically with the rest of the world in a guaranteed manner unless I am a miner. Now, another example, if I am American Express, I'm going to become a miner. Why? Okay. What I would do as American Express is I would go to all of my customers, my high net worth customers, my corporate customers, and I would say, pay $1,000 a year and get the American Express gold card, the American Express orange card, and you get X number of free transactions. You get one free Bitcoin transaction per month on us. And so you're guaranteed access and you're guaranteed it for free. If I was Citibank, I would do the same thing, right? I would say, this is what I want to do. So now the economic incentive for mining has really little to do with the block reward. And the choice of the transactions going in the block for a lot of the miners is completely different than the current incentive, because it's about guaranteeing sovereignty. It's about giving guaranteed access. It's not about making the money, because the importance is not directly economic. It's secondary.
Yeah, it's such a fascinating idea, and I think We are already seeing announcements and even, like, you know, you can read between the lines and think that large countries are probably already constructing significant mining facilities. Like, you know, Russia is to me an obvious example where there have been a number of different announcements about how they're warming up to large scale mining. And then the idea that there have been a few politicians talking about mining will become a matter of national security more than, as you're saying, more than a business.
And I know this is a wild concept again for Bitcoiners, but for the institutions that I'm talking about, not that there's anything wrong with owning Bitcoin, but that's not really that important to them. Like, how big is their stack is not what's important. What's important is the control of the monetary network, right? Having autonomy and sovereignty within the monetary network. And so when I look at what's happening in Bhutan, when I look at which for those who aren't familiar, Bhutan, small country of 1 million people in Southeast Asia, they have been mining. They've now mined about 13,000 Bitcoin. That's wonderful for them. But I think what they've also done is they've guaranteed that they will have financial freedom going forward. El Salvador has done the same thing. Now, whether that this was part of their master plan or not, I don't know. But it will be, I think, a major contributor to those countries flourishing. And we already know, like Fidelity already mines. You know, Swan, I know they've been in the public with all the with some hoopla recently, but they were into mining. And I think there's a certain, whether they succeed in that or not, I don't know. But I think this is what you're going to see. You're going to see companies emerge, and maybe big companies and big organizations and maybe even nation states fail because they didn't do this right. If I was, like I said, we'll use Libya again. If I was the president of Libya, what I would be doing right now is I would send a message out to the world and I would say, hey, bring your mining to Libya and you're going to get really cheap energy for, you know, let's say we're going to give you a penny a kilowatt hour for your hash power, but you must use the Libya pool. You must let us create the block templates for your hashing power. That's the price of admission. And if they don't attract enough capital to hit their goals, then they've got to redirect the capital assets of the country and do it themselves. But I would be doing everything I can to create that. Now, it's important that some of the traditional miners with the traditional mindset continue to exist, whether that's at the pleb level, what my company does, which we call horse class mining, which is kind of small to medium-sized commercial sites. We need some percentage of the network that will prioritize transactions in a slightly more traditional manner, because and even if it's 10 or 20% of the network, that may be enough. But I think, you know, down the road, that's probably all there will be. It'll probably be 10 or 20% maybe that exists with a somewhat traditional mindset where they're motivated more by the block reward and the direct benefits of the block, but most of it will be done in this other fashion.
Wild. I can't help but think about, we're in Canada. Not only does the Bank of Canada not own a single ounce of gold, but the province that I live in, British Columbia, which is abundant in hydro, it's actually next to impossible to get an electricity hookup to use for the purpose of Bitcoin mining in British Columbia. So, to your point about nation states may end up collapsing for doing it wrong, it's a catastrophe. What's going on up here as far as seeing where this is going?
Yeah. And, you know, the sad thing is that, you know, I think that, I shouldn't say sad. I think the cool thing is, I'll rephrase it completely. I think the cool thing is those countries that are aggressive and do this right, not only will they have a stash of Bitcoin that they build, a great treasury, but then they're going to preserve their sovereignty. And I think you'll see new types of alliances occur too. Like Bhutan may align with Nepal and Thailand and a few other countries that it has friendly relations with and say, well, we'll work together in a NATO-like alliance to mine together and respect each other's mempools. Meaning that, you know, so imagine that the citizens of these countries and companies of these countries, their transactions are recognized by the national node or the alliance node. And again, get a special priority. And so I think you'll see those same sort of things. You know, I think it's kind of a the embodiment of Jason Lowry and, you know, his Soft Wars book and some of his talks. You know, he talks about hash power and, you know, kind of takes this thought process of it being part of the Department of Defense sort of angle. And I get where he's coming. I think I'm coming at it similar ancillary way, saying that, you know, it's kind of a financial institution thing, and it's not as much the hash power, but the block space control that really is the key thing. They're certainly related, hash power and block space control, but it's scary, and I think it will happen. I may be wrong about the timeline. I think it happens very fast, and I think the like, I've spent a lot of time in El Salvador. I think they're doing all the right things. I think that they will become a mega financial center. They will be the Singapore of Central and South America, and their progressive thoughts about going into mining will be a big part of that.
Yeah, I think it's easy to imagine Central America sort of becoming another one of these economic zones, friendly economic zones that that orient themselves early around Bitcoin, because, you know, there's lots of rumblings here from Samson Mao and others that there's multiple countries in that region that are studying very closely what El Salvador has been up to.
Yeah. You know, these countries, they don't have anything to lose. It's so much easier for them to make this leap and take this chance because they have no downside. Can it be any worse than the world they've been in of being under the suppression from the IMF and the World Bank and sitting in a disadvantaged position in the you know, global monetary system? It really can't get any worse than what they've had to deal with. So it's a lot easier for them, I think, to make these kind of investments, because it's like we often talk about Bitcoin being an asymmetric bet, right? That it has massive upside and very little downside. And it's the same, I think, this kind of investment would be the same for those kind of countries. They're not losing anything. But for Canada or the United States, there's a lot to lose. But look at Russia. You know, we don't know a lot about what's happening in Russia, but there is a lot of mining activity. We know that for sure. It makes sense for them, even from Putin on down, to do this for the very reasons we talked about. Again, not so much because they want the Bitcoin, but because Bitcoin as a monetary network lets them transact with anybody they want to transact with. They can sell oil, buy cars, you know, whatever it is they want to do in a way that they can't be restricted. And they put a lot of value in that today. They've learned how important it is and not to trust the West and these sort of things.
Oh, we did an episode with Nolan Bowerly a few months ago, and he was talking at length about what he believes will be sort of the light switch moment for Bitcoin globally is when a major energy player starts pricing oil in Bitcoin. And for anyone who didn't listen to that episode, it was a fascinating take on another really important global factor that could change things very quickly.
Yeah, certainly. I'm pretty sure it's happening already. But probably in a month, I think there's probably between Venezuela and Russia and Iran, I'm pretty sure somebody's already done it. We probably don't know about it yet. But I don't really view it as a bad thing. You know, even as an American, I think we have turned money in the monetary system into a weapon. And I think that's ethically and morally wrong. And so, you know, Bitcoin allows us for money to be money, for a monetary system to be open and fair and non-judgmental. I just had dinner last night with somebody who told me this story about they were a small business. They had just got a $3 million grant for something they were working on a few years ago. And the guy woke up one morning and went, and I think it was a Bank of America account, looked at the Bank of America account, and his business checking account, and it was zero. And of course, he thought it was a mistake, refreshed, nothing, called the bank, and they said, "Yes, sir, you don't have any money in the account." Like, well, what happened? So he ends up having to go through the whole thing. Well, somebody in this New York State Department of Revenue thought that his company hadn't paid their taxes properly, and they just
seized all the money. No judge, no jury, no trial, no notice, no appeal process, nothing. They just took the $3 million from him. And it took them like four months to weed through it and for them to admit they had made a mistake, and they gave him the money back. But what it did was like the power of to do that is jaw dropping. Like and I think we've seen enough cases like this for everybody to be afraid and to know that, hey, at any point in time, whether it's a mistake or whether it's malicious or, you know, directed at you, that you can be exposed. And so Bitcoin provides, you know, hope against that. But we have to be careful, because the thing I just talked about, if I am right, the institutions mining that may control the majority of mining won't look at it the same way. As I said before, it's important that we find financial viability for some percentage of the network that won't be subject to censorship, that will not comply with OFAC, that will, you know, do these things in the true spirit of Bitcoin. And that may, by the way, mean that a lot of plebs need to mine maybe at a loss. Just, you know, that we may need 10 million people out there spending $100 a month on electricity and getting $60 a month in rewards, and essentially looking that as, you know, it's the price of freedom. It's the price of maintaining this sovereignty. Because if we let 100% of the mining network, meaning 100% of the block template creation, occur inside this kind of institutional nation state level thing,
we have Ethereum.
Yes. Well said. Well said.
So it all started with you a long time ago, understanding, you know, where things could go with the distribution of computing, and 40 years later, here we are. I think this is so cool, Bob, and I've learned a lot listening to you, and I'm grateful for you coming on the show. This has been it's been a very insightful conversation for me.
Thank you, Scott. Pleasure to spend time with you.
And if you're listening and you made it all the way to the end of the show, I want to thank you as well for tuning in, and hope to see you again next week. Bob, before we sign off, for listeners who want to find more of you online, is there any way in particular we can direct them?
I'm on Twitter at boomer_BTC. I have a YouTube show of my own called Old Man Yells. And my company is Barefoot Mining, just at barefootmining.com.
Great.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Block Reward. We're trying to do something different here, creating accessible conversations meant for people who aren't obsessed with Bitcoin. If you found this episode informative and engaging, hit that subscribe button to make sure you stay updated with future episodes. Your feedback matters. We'd greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to share your reviews and help us with our goal of creating Bitcoin content that is simple and easy to understand. Bitcoin has an important role to play in the future of finance. It will change the way we save, spend, and invest. Discover why Bitcoin offers a game-changing opportunity for forward-thinking employers by visiting blockrewards.ca. Block Rewards' mission is helping Canadian employers implement strategies for integrating Bitcoin into compensation and benefits. Supercharge your recruitment and retention strategies, and help your team members plan for the rising cost of living by rewarding their work with the hardest money ever invented. Special thanks to our top sponsor, Paramount Employee Benefits Consulting, Canada's only Bitcoin-forward benefits and pension advisory. For more information, find them at paramountbenefits.ca. Big shout out to Podigy, our production team that makes all this possible, and VMX Escape for producing our music. Bitcoin is an expansive and dense topic many people walk away from early. To Bitcoin enthusiasts looking for that podcast they can share with friends, family, and colleagues, one they'll actually listen to, we hope that is us. The content of these conversations is meant to be provided for information purposes only. Nothing here is investment advice. Bitcoin is a big topic. Be sure to do your own research before making any personal financial decisions. Thanks for listening.